and welcome to today's episode of Just Cause. I'm your host, Rhianne Scott. In today's episode, I chat with Inspector Dan Jones of the Edmonton Police Service and Melissa Neal. Dan and Melissa met years ago when Dan was working on foot patrol in the city of Edmonton, Canada, and Melissa was a young person finding herself in conflict with the law. As the years progressed, Dan and Melissa developed a special friendship. Dan refused to give up on Melissa as she moved in and out of the justice system, providing her with support, guidance, encouragement, and friendship, and she leaned on him for help and support. Melissa's story is a really important one to share. In this discussion, she's open and vulnerable, talking about her struggles in steering herself out of a life of crime and addiction. Her story and the insight she shares as someone who has come out on the other end shows how important having someone care and believe in you is. That there are many layers and trauma that often exist for those who find themselves in the criminal justice system. And the simple power of caring, asking how someone is, and treating them like a human being. There's so much to learn out of this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. On to the episode. Hey, welcome everyone to today's episode of Just Cause. I am so pleased to be able to bring you two very special guests. And we're going to be doing something a little bit different in today's episode by having two guests and myself have a conversation together. And you'll see why as we get going. But this is a special relationship that has formed over the years, and we'll give that some more discussion. But let me get them to introduce themselves first. So, Dan, why don't I start with you, please?
Sure. My name is Dan Jones. I'm currently with the Edmonton Police Service. I'm an inspector, and I've been with the organization for just about 25 years.
Perfect. And Melissa?
And I'm Melissa Neal. Melissa Dawn Neal, and I'm just Dan's friend.
Well, I'm sure you're much more than that too, but thank you. I appreciate the time that both of you are giving to this.
Just going to say one thing. Melissa's in her last day of her field placement with the Edmonton help team.
Yes.
Fantastic. Congratulations. That's great. Then we'll definitely have to talk a little bit more around that as well. All right. So why don't we get started? I am curious around, if we can talk a little bit around what life was like for you both before you met.
Well, for me, I'm originally from Winnipeg, Manitoba, and very common. I grew up north side Winnipeg, right in the grids of hardship. Ended up here when I was 8. And kind of took care of myself as well. So I just, it was a tough go. My mom was an alcoholic, drug addict. My father was gone. So I mostly took care of myself on the streets or wherever I can get acceptance. So I moved to Edmonton when I was 8, and it went on from there.
Okay. Well, thank you, Melissa, firstly, for just being so open with your experience. I really appreciate that. And I know that the audience does and will as well. Thank you. And Dan, how about you? What was life for you before you met Melissa?
So I was a snot-nosed new cop, very in my role, kind of just living my what I thought was my best life. Trying to play, almost trying to play in between cop and gangster.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So then how did you two find each other? And I don't mean to say, I feel like this is like, I was talking about a romantic conversation like we met, but no, I obviously you both found and met each other. I'm curious around how that was and how you started your relationship.
I would, I'd say I was, like I said, went on from there in a dark place in my life. And I tend to roam the streets at that age. So from like 10 to on, I got into alcohol and drugs and started hanging out with some individuals that probably weren't the greatest for me in my life, role models wise. And we met behind, if you've ever known, there's a place in Edmonton called the Cromdale Hotel on 118th Ave, and that was pretty famous back in the day. And I think he was doing, Dan Jones was doing a patrol, and he ended up running into me in the back of the hotel.
Okay. Okay.
Coming out of the 10 years old.
Yeah, I was 16.
With Wildberry Cooler.
Yeah, and see him.
So Dan, do you remember it that way as well? Any thoughts that go through your mind from that first memory?
Oh yeah, we were in the back of the. I was in the back of the Cromdale, just hanging out because a lot of stuff happened at that hotel. It's no longer in existence. It's actually been mowed down. But I remember her coming out and her little track pants and her little T-shirt and being a little gangster.
Yeah. I was 10 feet tall and bulletproof.
Absolutely.
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. So in that first encounter, how has then your relationship evolved? So maybe talk, if you don't mind, maybe around how that first encounter then kind of evolved from that first meeting behind the hotel through to how it is today.
Well, I think Melissa would probably agree with me when I say this. I was a different kind of police officer. I police differently than most do. I was all about developing relationships, but I was also all about getting people in jail too. Yeah. Back in the day. And I ended up, that area ended up becoming my foot patrol area. And I ended up walking it for almost 5 years and interacting with individuals who were criminally involved and communities. And I saw something in Melissa right away that she was way better than the life she was giving herself. So I just really, really liked her, and I made her my mission at times. She would show up at the house. I'd be there with her mom. Mm-hmm. And she's an awesome person. She's one of my closest friends. And the way it started, a lot of people wouldn't think that that could ever happen in a policing experience or a justice experience. And some people say, oh, there's no boundaries there. And I say, we're human beings. And how do we make sure that people get taken care of rather than just, you know, tossed away?
I think that's such an important point, because I think people really do talk a lot about boundaries a lot and not getting too close or too emotional or involved. But, you know, I think the way you've just described it, as we're humans and taking care of each other, is just a really nice way to put it. And yeah, Melissa, you know, just hearing Dan reflect on that, I mean, what do you remember what some of your thoughts or feelings were at that time, at that first encounter, and you know, how you started to perhaps build a relationship that where you trusted him?
Well, if anybody knows me, I'm very loud and proud, so I'm very affectionate that way. So and I feel like I picked up his energy, as in he was talking to me like a human. I wasn't a street person. I was just a young girl that needed someone to hear me out, you know. And he never came across to me as an, I'm a police officer and I'm going to make sure that you are going to pay for everything that you've done wrong. And no, it wasn't like that. It was very, how are you? And nobody ever asked me that, you know, how are you doing? How's it going? How's life? Like, what you've been up to, you know, really concerned. And that caught me right there. And I've always been very comfortable with the police. And regardless if I was around street people or not, I didn't care. And I got into a lot of trouble for that. I paid for it excessively. And but only because that's just me. Like I said, loud and proud. I didn't care who I was talking to. And I see that that energy come off on Dan a lot. I've seen some of the biggest gangsters talk and walk with Dan side by side, and they wouldn't be ashamed just because he has that connection with people, right? And And I got that. I was lucky enough to be able to build that relationship right off the bat. It was comfortable.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's such good insight. And, you know, Dan, why do you think that there is a bit of a barrier, you know, in terms of, and I don't know, maybe if it comes back to the boundaries discussion, but for, you know, fellow peers in policing, how can they replicate that? Where is that gap?
You know, what's interesting is I think it comes right from training. You know, if you look at, and I don't want to get all academic or statistics on you, but if you look at in Canadian policing, forces use 0.7 of the times that we interact with people. When you look at police training, our training is very heavy on what oftentimes is referred to as core training, the shooting, the driving, the arrest control, right? So we almost teach everybody that everybody you deal with is a threat.
Mm.
That mindset to me isn't the proper mindset because, you know, and this has been a long discussion and it's gone into things about the warrior mindset of policing. We're not warriors. We're not at war with anybody. We're guardians. We are and should be capable guardians. And to me, it's about people. My upbringing led me to the way I police. I grew up very privileged on the south side of Edmonton. My dad was a cop, but almost every one of my friends growing up ended up incarcerated. I was a correctional officer before I was a police officer. I had friends of mine that were in my units in prison. So that having that background, it showed me a lot that these folks are humans. And my friends, I never thought they were bad people. They made some decisions I didn't make, or maybe they made some decisions. They got caught for decisions because I've done some things in my life. And I've talked about this a lot. When I was 18 years old, I got arrested for assault causing bodily harm and I got let go because I'm a white kid and my dad was a cop. And I realized that privilege and having those experiences made me really want to not just police, but wanted me to be a part of the community. And being a part of the community doesn't just be me being a part of the law-abiding community. I remember, and Melissa will know this, I'd walk into active drug houses in my uniform, go grab a Coca-Cola out of the fridge. I say Coca-Cola because I want to make sure everyone's clear that that's what I'm grabbing out of the fridge. And I'd sit down on the couch and people, I think half the times they kind of were like, I don't know. They didn't know how to take me because I did things differently and it doesn't make me special. It's just as a result of my background.
I'm curious then, Dan, you know, those are some, I think the training point is such a key one. And I'm curious around, you know, Melissa, your thoughts when you and Dan started working together, how did some of your friends or acquaintances or kind of people around your circle take that? Did they view the police in a different way? Did they view you differently in terms of the way you were working with Dan? What were some of your experiences that way?
I feel like a lot of my run-ins with Dan were because I was at the wrong place at the wrong time or just doing stupid shit that I, sorry for my language, but it's where he probably needed to be there, right? And I always call Dan my guardian angel. He is my guardian angel. Gave me more than I can count. There's times where, like I said, wrong time, wrong place, and he shows up out of nowhere like a ninja and like saves me from something that I probably could have got myself in deep, 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 deep trouble, right? Worse than I've ever have. I think it took a long time for people to realize the connection that I had with Dan. And once they started realizing, it wasn't always good. And that's the truth. Like I've had a lot of arguments, fights, domestic and you name it over Dan. Because I was so connected with him, I fought what I believe in. It came to a point where I didn't even care anymore. Right. I did fight for my relationship with Dan a lot.
Are you okay talking about testifying in court?
Yeah.
So I'll tell you just as a, actively in the lifestyle still, we have a homicide in Edmonton. And it was a woman, I shouldn't say, I won't say her name. It was a relatively elderly woman. And she got killed by a sex trade worker in her garage. sorry, she got killed by a sexual worker in her garage. And the person went back, took the money to a drug house. It became this really convoluted investigation where one gang called up a tip on another gang. So the police were actually going the wrong direction. And Melissa and another woman that was connected with Melissa, they basically came to me and told me who did it. And not just like they told me who did it, and then they were willing to write statements and go to court and testify in an open court. And then at a later date had to go back into jail after testifying in open court around everyone knew that she was testifying, not just because it was the right thing to do, but because we had a connection and all of a sudden now she's put herself in harm's way to do the right thing.
That is a hugely brave thing to do, Melissa. I imagine it meant a lot to the victim's family. How did you deal with that? And you know, what kind of drove your decision to go ahead and testify?
I think it was the most of the trauma that what was going on in front of my face, and the thought of an older person like, yeah, okay, I'm drinking. Yeah, okay, I'm doing drugs. Yeah, I'm hanging out with the wrong people, but still, there's no reason for an older person to be hurt for no reason, right? And I've made some really shitty decisions in my life, but that's one thing that I couldn't fathom to even accept, right? So, and then to even see things that happened to the accused. Yeah. Like, she had gotten really brutally beaten, in a closet and in front of me. So like to see that was like, okay, this is enough. That's enough. And, yeah, like Dan said, I went to jail after that. Back in the day, Fort Saskatchewan, it was like a public bathroom. So you walk in and it's not like individual stalls. In that one, it's more public. You walk in and it's a public bathroom. There's about 6 or 7 stalls. And I went to the washroom and all I could hear is about 6 or 7 girls come walking in, banging on the doors. Like, and I knew I was the only one in there. Of course, I'm sitting on the toilet, like, okay. And I put my foot on the door and I knew right away, as soon as I walk out, that was it. And sure enough, I barged out and started swinging because I knew exactly what was going to happen. It was all because of this. And yeah, it was a good fight. As soon as I was done, I ran to my room, closed the door, looked down, my white shirt was full of blood, and I changed my shirt, tried to like breathe it out. And I sat on my bed and just stared at the wall. Sure enough, they were doing checks. She looks in my room. This was in between snack time when they're handing out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Oh my goodness.
And yeah, so all the constables were busy at the time. But when they were doing checks, she looked at me, she looked in my room, looked and realized that this wasn't right. And yeah, so she pulls me out of the room, puts me in the closet or in the office and says, what happened? Who did this? And of course I was petrified because I was thinking like, what's next, right? And I said, I don't know. I couldn't see. I didn't know. There was just too many people. I don't know. And because I wasn't telling the truth, they actually kicked me out of Fort Saskatchewan and shipped me off to Lethbridge because I wasn't allowed to be locked up more than a certain amount of times because it was public, right? So it wasn't isolation or anything like that. So yeah, it was, I've gone through a lot of situations like that. And it wasn't because of Dan. It was just because of, like I said earlier, what I believe in, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, those are such strong principles to be standing behind in the face of that kind of fear and threat. And I wonder if you feel comfortable, Melissa, you know, speaking about, you know, some of your experiences in jail, how did you manage and get through? What kind of kept you going to get to the other side on release?
The honest truth, fighting. I fought my way in and out, like, and it was always someone coming at me all the time. my last bit was almost a little over a year. And yeah, it was someone's always in my face and I had to defend myself even in my sleep. So that's the truth. I've probably gotten into about over 100 fights in my life. So, and 90% of them were because I was in jail and defending my life.
Wow. I can't imagine what that must be like. So I appreciate you sharing that. Absolutely. And I wonder if there was a turning point, you know, what, I don't know if it was maybe your last time in jail, or if there was a point where you thought something needs to change, I need to do something different. Was there a moment like that for you, or did it just kind of evolve over time?
Absolutely, there was. I will never forget this day. I woke up and I was half cut by noon. I was drunk and starting to do drugs. And for some reason, somehow I had 6 ounces of meth in my pocket, about $4,000 in my bra, and 26 grams of marijuana, pills, all kinds of stuff. And I was out of my tree, and I got into an argument with a person that was in the apartment, and all of a sudden this big guy, 6'4", 5", 300 and some pounds, comes out of nowhere. And I'm yelling, screaming, kicking, whatever I'm doing. And he puts his arm gently on my arm and he says, "It's okay. Just calm down." And of course, no one tells me to calm down, right? Like, I'm like, okay, nope. And I'm 95 pounds, soaking wet. And I jump off a couch and I Superman punch him and start beating him up. He falls so hard on the ground that the pictures off the wall come off. And I start jumping on him. He got cut from his chin all the way up to his ear. He has a scar still to this day. So I take off with all my drugs, my money, and I'm running down 95th Street and I'm thinking, I don't know, it was like 115th or something. And of course I get surrounded by cops. And yeah, so I got charged with possession of the purpose of trafficking because I had money and drugs, assault with a deadly weapon. I didn't have a weapon, but I'm a weapon. Yeah, I'm a weapon. And yeah, so I go to jail and trial comes and I'm still incarcerated and I go to court. And the guy that I beat up is standing in the courtroom. And my lawyer shows me some pictures of what I've done to this man. That was the first time I seen him like that since I didn't even know who he was. So that was the first time I seen what I did since I've been sitting in jail. And my mentality prior to me looking at those pictures was like, huh, whatever, you know? And, when I looked at those pictures, his face was demolished and it was horrible. It was a horrible scene. And my guilty conscience kicked in right away. And I looked at the guy and I started crying. And that was the worst feeling, like thinking I almost took that man's life. He was in the hospital for 3 weeks for that. So he had an opportunity to share what he needed to share in the courtroom. And the most kindest words I've ever heard anyone say, he said, there was 3 people at this apartment and they were all intoxicated. He said, if I could take a beating and save one person out of 3, he says, I've done a good job. He says, I wish the best for her. And I looked at him and I was like, is this guy like kidding? Like he just said, it's okay what I just did. Cause it's not, like I'm thinking to myself. Right. Mm-hmm. And he gave me that green light to be like, okay, enough is enough. So that man forgave me for what I did, for almost taking his life. And that was it for me.
Wow. That is such a powerful experience. Did you stay in touch with this man at all? Do you ever still encounter him?
So legally I was not allowed to be around him for a certain amount of time. I had probation. I had rules and regulations that I need to follow by when I got released. And that was the only time I've ever seen that guy in the courtroom. And then I was in a meeting when I finally was allowed to run around and do what I needed to do in society. And I went to a meeting and I was at the coffee cafe area where the meeting was. And let me rephrase that. I was at a NA meeting, an alcohol narcotics anonymous meeting. I was grabbing a coffee and I felt this little tap on my shoulder. And I looked around, I looked at him and he had this guy with a big, huge scar on his face and he's huge. And I looked up at him and he goes, "Hi, Melissa." And I went, "Oh my God, do I owe this guy money? Like, who is this guy?"
Right? Yeah.
I was scared because I was like, I was my first few days or weeks or whatever out since whenever. Right. And, it's me. And he says his name and I still don't remember. And he goes, July 11th, 2004. And I went, that's the day I went to jail. Like, well, you know, and then I realized it kicked in right away. And he says, "Don't worry." He goes, "I forgive you and I'm proud of you." And he shook my hand.
Gosh. Wow.
I've been a few times in meetings and stuff. He actually ended up being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And like, he was a recovering alcoholic addict too, as well. So like I said, there's little things in my life that people come in and come. Yeah, they've blessed me with amazing energy like that. So
that's hugely powerful. Thank you for sharing that story. You know, Dan, listening to Melissa speak about this, I mean, what are your thoughts? What's going through your mind as she described that experience?
Well, what goes through my mind every time I hear Melissa speak is how proud I am of her. Knowing that, you know, those things happened, and then she ended up getting for the doing drug court for the drugs, which I think was a huge experience, a positive experience for her. Rather than, and the judge at the time, is it Darlene Wong?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
She was a very compassionate woman, and she ran drug court, and she saw and wanted to ensure that people never came back, and Melissa never came back. And it was interesting because after all of this, there's no more legal reason for me to be involved in Melissa's life because she's no longer involved in crime. But we stayed in contact because we have a strong connection. In fact, she got married and I was at her wedding. Oh, which,
congratulations.
That's no
we're
longer
divorced. They're divorced.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, okay. But congratulations on that then too.
Interesting because there were people at the wedding that were still currently involved in gang activity and heavy hitters. And technically I was breaching policy because I shouldn't have been there because we have policies not to, to be in rooms with socializing with people with criminal records. And I didn't care. And it was Melissa's wedding. And it was, I think one of the funniest things in the world was that the very end of the, you know, your, whatever that little lineup is, whatever they call that. I'm shaking hands of the best man who was one of the individuals who actually started the Red Alert in the Red Alert Street Gang, which is notorious across at least Western Canada now. But that's again, Melissa putting herself out there and all the guys now, I know them for the most part. Most of them, I could walk into most of their houses and have a conversation. And I'm oddly accepted in gang life by a lot of different people in a lot of different street gangs, which is also kind of odd. But yeah, it's been amazing. And it's a gift that Melissa's given is in policing, and I say this all the time, Melissa's heard me say it, we deal with someone in one chapter of their life. Mm-hmm. We deal with I always use chapter six, because we don't get to see 1 through 5, and we never get to see 6 through 12. And 6 through 12 could be a tragedy. It could be a story of epic success, like Melissa. And I think that's one of the things that we fail in justice, is to allow people to see the whole story, because all we do is get cynical and angry and think that nothing ever changes. Well, things change. Melissa's working at the police. Like, she's hopefully going to be employed in the health program soon. That's her goal. I know it's my goal. And having her work here, she brings something to the table. And it was funny, because we did some training on trauma. We did a 3-day trauma training, and Melissa was there, and she put it on one of her accounts, Facebook, I think it was, or whatever. And mm-hmm. Another person who I've been connected to, she sends back to Melissa, "Hey, that's my dad." And that's an individual who I arrested and incarcerated for mm-hmm. conspiracy to commit murder. And
oh my gosh,
I'm going to her wedding in April. So, and I think I might be walking her down the aisle, but, that's these, you know, I don't do policing for promotion. I don't do policing for notoriety count. I don't want to be noticed. I did policing for this. Mm-hmm. And I got the gift from Melissa and some other folks that shows me that I don't care if people didn't like how I police. Cause I swam upstream a lot in policing, still do. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the right way to do it. I think we need to change how we do justice, because we're not dealing with good and bad. We're dealing with human beings. And that's why I use justice client, because whether you're a victim or an offender, you're a client of the system. And we need to stop labeling the offender and going, "You're nothing but," because far too often people will strive to the label that they're given. And until they're given permission to do something different by somebody that is genuinely compassionate with them, they won't change, because we've told them what they are.
You know, I couldn't agree more with that. It's, you know, I feel like when the justice machine basically gets up and running, it just takes over with process and going through lots of different mechanical steps. And I think so often the people who are most impacted become least involved, and the outcomes that are trying to be achieved to support them in whichever way they need, I think sometimes it gets lost in all of that process. And I think putting people back at the center and re-looking at, what does it mean to deliver justice? What do people need? What do people want? And how is that brought back in? So it's not just doing things that are right for the actors that are in the justice system, but actually for citizens and the community and the people that are impacted, and the whole reason why the whole justice machine has spun up. And, you know, I'm curious from both of you, I mean, what do you think would be, you know, some of the, maybe some tangible changes that could be done, you know, relatively soon, or should be done first to try and make a difference? Whether that's in policing or justice overall, but to make things better for people, have a greater focus on the outcomes.
I've said this in training too, with a room full of police officers that are just learning this kind of stuff too. And the one question that Dan said was, "What is policing to you?" Mm-hmm. And like going naming off whatever they could name off, serve and protect and solving crimes and, you know, solving problems. And the one thing was that really hit home for me was to have empathy for anyone, everyone, no matter who it is, even the biggest, baddest guys out there. And like I said, Dan has had that connection with everybody because he's given that empathy and that compassion to people. No matter where they come from, you don't know what they've gone through, right? And like Dan says, he's also been very privileged. He's white and he's a cop, and you know, he comes from a family of cops, and so he, you know, people look at that like, "You don't know what you're talking about." But just as much as he's been privileged, he's also lived a life out there with us. Mm-hmm. He's been out, and he, like he said, he walked into to a drug house and sat down on the couch and talked with everybody that's probably half cut or high out of the tree. And he still has a conversation no matter what, like, you know, and so, and also building that rapport, that connection with everybody and not giving up. Once you build that connection with somebody, don't give up on them. And I will say it over and over again. Dan has never given up on me, no matter how much I pushed him away and told him to F off or like, leave me alone. You don't know me. Like, I was a young punk going, whatever, right? Like,
what are you doing in my house?
Yeah. What are you doing in my house? I'm off. Yeah. So, like things like that, you know, but, he didn't care. He knew exactly what I was going through. He knew that it was just me being angry and never giving up. And he didn't judge me. You've seen me at my worst. And like, I've looked pretty shitty some days, like, and where I thought I was probably looking like death. And he never gave up or judged me for it. You know, he also purposely came out to look for me if he hasn't seen me in a couple of days or weeks. And those are the things that like I would tell any other member of the police service anywhere, it's all over the world. Build that rapport. Don't give up.
I remember once Melissa was.
Yeah.
And her mom had called her in missing because she'd been gone for like probably 6 or 7 days. Mm-hmm. And there was a place called the Lock Apartments. 112 and was it 92? Mm-hmm. It doesn't even exist anymore. And I don't know if you remember this, but I found you in the Lock Apartments and I knocked on every single door mm-hmm. of the apartment, like every single one. Okay. And I'm like, one's in trouble. I'm just looking for Lala, which was her back in the day. And, just, and you know, if even to this day, I'll bump into people and I'll be like, oh, Melissa, I don't know if you know, Melissa Neal's doing really well as well. Or Melissa's doing really well. They're like, ooh. I'm like, Lala. Oh yeah, Melissa. those names,
yeah,
or handles become important, but it's true, and it's like you. And I totally agree with what she's saying. Is that we? It's not. They're just the individuals we deal with are not just part of our job. They are part of our life, and the more we realize that, the more we'll probably do a better job. There's no. I don't think there's any evidence on this, but it would be interesting to look at it. Being psychologically healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Sit there and think everyone is bad and nothing's going to change, then why do we do this? And how does that impact us, that if our job has done nothing successfully, when we have the ability to be on along for a journey with folks, right? And that's a pretty cool thing.
Absolutely. Do you think that you either have empathy or not? Do you think it's something that can be taught or learned, or is it something that you think is just inherent in some people and not others?
I think you can learn empathy. I think not everyone can. I don't think it's 100%. I think some people can learn it. I think you can bring it out in some people. One of the things what we do at trauma training, and that was a trauma training that Melissa just took, I always bring someone with lived experience to talk, because me standing up there talking to a bunch of police officers and there's social navigators in the room too is one thing. But when someone starts to talk and you get to see that full book of someone, right? And the person I had talked last time was a friend of mine that we went to high school together, and he ended up in jail when I was there. And he tells his story and people are looking at him going, well, that story's not that different than mine. There's just a couple of different turns. And I think we build compassion by telling stories. And I, mm-hmm. you know, about that, where we're sitting right now, like we're sitting on Treaty 6 land right now, and the stories have been so important for the Indigenous community for so long. It's how things pass from generation to generation. And I think the importance of stories, and not just telling stories, but hearing the stories. And if the people on the other side of that place are willing to hear those stories, you can't help but start to be compassionate. But that's the part, we have to be a little bit vulnerable and we have to allow ourselves to listen. And I do think we can teach it. I think we can work it in. I think we should work it into policing. I think compassion should be a competency in policing. It's not in most police agencies. It's, you have things like accountability and integrity and courage. Well, I don't think there's anything as courageous as compassion.
Absolutely. I'm curious then, Melissa, so, you know, going back to that, to the experience you were describing that really drove you to saying, you know, no more, I'm going to do things differently. How did your life then evolve from there to where you are today?
It definitely was a struggle to be absent from drugs and alcohol, the people, places, and things. It was normal to me, right? I grew up with it. My mom was an alcoholic, and everybody she hung out with was an alcoholic, drug addict. My mom was actually part of, back in the day, it was called Los Bravos before they became the Angels. Mm-hmm. And it was Manitoba. And that was like, that was my mom. She was, use my language, but top dog biker bitch, you know, and she'd had the chaps and she had the leathers, and that's who I grew up with. Right. So it was normal to me to see all that kind of stuff. Mm. The one thing that I always remember, you play by the gun, you're going to die by the gun. You know what I mean? And, so that was one thing that I just didn't want to do. I didn't want to be 6 feet under. Mm-hmm. I didn't want my mom to overlive me. You know what I mean? Like, I was also very, I would say I was very, very scared to be alone. And I was alone a lot, and I was tired of being alone. So I think that was another turning point for me too. I just didn't want to be alone anymore. To build that, I put one foot in front of the other. I cried every day. There wasn't a night that I didn't go to sleep crying myself to bed, you know, for a good year, I would say. For a good year, I struggled. Sometimes the thought in my head, or I would smell alcohol and or drugs or something, I could sniff it out like a wolf. And it was a struggle, but I was consistent with my meetings. I was consistent with reaching out to Dan a lot. If I had a bad day, I'd call him. I'd call somebody. Sometimes when I was even too scared of my own self, I would just hide and just sit there until I could calm down. I dealt with a lot of mental health. It was just pushing through. It was just pushing through and remembering what I did not want. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be 6 feet under. I didn't want to be alone, you know, and I didn't want to have a lot of conditions that a lot of people have now. Like the people I used with back in the day are in wheelchairs, dead, or have huge anxiety problems. For like they just have, their life is not the same anymore, mm-hmm. right? These drugs. So
we've lost a lot of people from yes. men recently in the last little while.
Yeah.
We've had a lot of deaths, whether it's be suicide or accidental drug poisoning. Mm-hmm. We just lost a lot of people, and it just seems to be a lot lately.
Yeah. And one of the co-founders of Red Alert just passed away too, but he was never the same.
No,
he was never the same. He dealt with a lot of mental health, a lot of psychosis, just wasn't. But the one thing that I can remember about him was he was very, very, very talented. Mm-hmm. He could draw any piece of art you wanted, and he was amazing at it. And I think right before he passed away, he says, I want to get out of this life. I want to talk to the youth. I want to encourage people. Let them know that this is not the way of life. He was done, and he ended up being done. Like he passed away last month.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So recent. That is just really sad.
Yeah. And I will say this about, you know, the vast majority of those people, those guys in the street gangs, when you get them one-on-one and you have conversations with them, they don't want that life. They And when they, especially when they start to trust you, they don't want it. They can't say it out loud because that's dangerous for them. They don't want to look weak, but the amount of times I've sat with gang members in an office where they're safe and seen them cry and going, I don't know what to do. And here's the other thing you asked, what do we do? Give us something, give them something to do. Let's increase the ability for people to get cognitive behavior therapy. Let's increase community supports. Let's increase a diversity in ways to address substance use disorder and addiction, because we have linear streams often. We have, you got this, you got this, you got this. Well, that's not always going to work for somebody. And sometimes if we're not addressing the root cause, the trauma in the background, we're not going to do anything. And we're going to create either more problems or sustain the problems we have. But the amount of times I've had people ask me, what can I do to get out of a gang? Get out of a gang. There's no programming. What can I do to get out of the criminal lifestyle? We can work hard together. And there are people that are successful because Melissa's a determined fighter, right? Mm-hmm. She took what she talked about earlier, fighting, and she started, instead of fighting people, she started fighting. She started fighting for herself. And it's a transferable skill that she's used to become the best version of herself that she is now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Melissa, I'm curious around whether you have any advice for people who might right now be in the situation that you used to be in. What would you tell them or encourage them to do?
Actually, I have never been really asked that question in a long time, but I would say there's a rush, but there's no rush. Just take it one day at a time. Like a lot of times it's like, okay, let's go to treatment. Let's go do this. Let's go do that. Let's go do this right away. And no, because a lot of people get overwhelmed with, okay, this is way too much. I'm going to go back and use. I can't handle it anymore. It's too stressful. So we actually had a little bit of a training the other day, and one of the exercises was trying to focus on a problem solving, and someone is distracting you. And this one lady comes up behind me and she's like, oh, and she starts talking. And I was like irritated because she was in my bubble. She was in my space. And she was talking, right? And it was too fast. Even after all these years of me being sober, I was like, okay, I wanted to elbow smash her, get out of my way. You know what I mean? Like, but I didn't. I just thought about it. So like, I think take it slow one day at a time. And they're like, everything that you're going to do is a process. So I think reassure yourself every day. Wake up and be like, okay, I could do this. I did it alone. I honestly did this alone. I had Dan, but I mean, like, he wasn't in there with me in the jail cell talking, where I was like, okay, another day, this is almost over, you know? And, it sounds crazy, but talk to yourself. Mm-hmm. You're worth it. I can do this. And there's so many resources out there. Reach out, because I struggled so much is because I didn't really reach out as much as I should have. You know what I mean? So I dealt with my mental health a lot longer than I should have. But just reach out and get your resources. Like, we're here to help you. The Edmonton Police Service Help Unit, we're here to help you. And that's like one thing that I learned out here. There's some really hard ships out there that people are just struggling with. They want it so bad. And you can see it in their eyes. They want it so bad, but they're just so stuck. Right. And that's what I love about help is we don't give up. Like, we keep going back to them. Hey, how are you doing today? Like Dan said to me, how are you? Mm-hmm. How are you? What can we do for you? You know what I mean? So if you need help, reach out to help. Like, seriously.
such wise words. And also, you know, in many ways, just that, how are you? There are just like three simple words that can just make such a huge difference in someone's life. So no, thank you for sharing.
And it's easier said than done. I know that. I know it's easier said than done, but really it's mind over matter. And that's even easier said than done, because sometimes you're just so in your head. Right. But I mean, like I said, I did this by myself. I didn't want to die. I didn't want to die.
It's just such hugely difficult stuff to deal with. Sorry, Dan, go ahead.
I think people in the system, like on both sides of it, have to realize that when you're on a journey to bettering yourself, it's not, there's no instant gratification there. When you're in active addiction, there's instant gratification. Mm-hmm. In criminality, there's instant gratification there. That's why a lot of people go, I got to get treatment. I'm going to work with youth tomorrow. This isn't instant gratification. This is a long game. And that's hard for people. I think it's hard for all of us, because it's really nice when I like doing something and building something and going, hey, that's, I did that. I'm not very good at it, but at least you actually see what your work product is. Mm-hmm. Melissa's been 18 years in the making of, from the moment she decided that this isn't what's going to happen anymore. And I guarantee you, and I know there's hard times still, mm-hmm. right? So you go to work for 18, 19, 20 for the rest of your life at being healthy. And that's the thing. Every one of us needs to do it. Mm-hmm. In order to be healthy, we have to work on ourselves. We are, Melissa said it, we are worth it. And we have to be willing to care about ourselves.
And Lee, like you've used for so many years, 10, 15 years, it's not going to take a day or two for you to feel better. It's going to take many years. I used for, I would say almost 10 years, 10 years I used, hard drugs. I drank every day. I used every day. I did crime almost every other day. And that lifestyle became normal to me. Mm-hmm. Trying to change that whole environment in my life was taking time. I'm going on 19 years here in July, will be 19 years, almost two decades of being clean and sober. And just now dealing with my past trauma of my childhood, you know what I mean? So it takes time. Like I've dealt with, my addictions aspect, my alcoholism, my day-to-day living, learning. I didn't even know how to pay a bill, my rent, or how to drive, or how to do normal life things, get up in the morning even and have a coffee. I didn't know how to do those things. Mm-hmm. Simple life things that I needed to learn and teach myself every single day, that it took this long for me to actually be like, I'm paying my taxes today. Right. And so now, like I said, almost 19 years sober, just dealing with my trauma of my childhood, of my father, mm-hmm. like my brothers, my mom, stuff like that. Things that the root of the problem was at the beginning that I'm just dealing with now. But I know that I need to deal with that in order for me to be out there and helping others as well. This is my passion. This is who I am. I owe it to everybody that has done that to me. For the ones that I wouldn't be able to say thank you to that are gone now today, this is me paying back forward. Is like being here today, waking up and just putting one foot in front of the other every single day, no matter what. So, yeah.
You have such a courageous story, Melissa. Honestly, I find it so inspiring, and I know that it will be inspiring to, you know, not just people who will be listening to this, but all of the people now that you are working with and encountering, just the journey you've been on, and also massive congratulations for almost 19 years. So that is a huge accomplishment. So it's fantastic. I'm wondering, Melissa, can you talk a little bit around what you're doing today and kind of what's driving you in your work and what are your goals at the moment?
So I would go back to Dan said, I married a gangster Well, partially now. He's old and used up. Just kidding. That was a long process. That was like almost 11 years mm-hmm. of emotional and physical and just all kinds of numbers of abuse that I've dealt with over the years with him. And so also he also suffers with brain damage. He also was batted back in 2000 and was probably, they said that he wasn't going to make it. He wasn't going to walk. He wasn't going to talk. And today he sure knows how to talk. He talks a lot. But he is alive today and well, but I mean, we went our separate ways, and that was a lot of trauma that I had to deal with too, just even with that. But what really got me interested in was his mental health. And I thank him all the time for being like, thank you so much for treating me the way you treated me, so I could learn a lot more about the acceptance of mental health and just the day-to-day basis of what people really, really go through. Right. So I decided to go to school. I ended up going to CDI College in Edmonton. And because of my lack of education, I actually had to take another program prior to that to get the credits to join this program. That's just me at 40 trying to catch up to all my education that I didn't get to do. Like I said, it takes a long time, right? So I graduated from the first program, and now November 19th, I will be graduating from Addictions and Mental Health.
Oh, congratulations.
Yes. For the first time I will ever be wearing a cape and gown.
That's excellent. Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm actually, my practical placement was with EPS Help Unit. I was the very first student to be placed with EPS Help Unit. And so grateful for it. That saying is not what you know, it's who you know. And for helping me out with that. I've had an amazing experience for the last 8 weeks here. And I've gone out the front lines of helping people and just like problem solving and learning a lot more about what's really going on out there. And so I'm grateful for everybody here. Everybody here is a really good, I would say, inspiration to all. And the EPS have chosen really amazing people to work with these community members. And I'm so impressed with the Help Unit. I did apply for the position. So it takes 2 weeks. Like I said, everything takes time. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I could be a member of the team in the near future. So that's what I'm doing here. I'm at the Help Unit right now.
That's fantastic. Well, congratulations on graduating very, very soon. And yeah, I hope, I wish you all the well or all the luck in getting that position. I really hope that works out for sure. And Dan, what does life look like for you right now?
For me, I'm still with EPS, but I'm seconded to the provincial government and I'm working on a couple of different projects. I'm Justice and Solicitor General, just about finished my PhD. My research is really around looking at trauma and the impacts of trauma on incarcerated men and women and how do we do better in the system. So I'm just doing that. And yeah, just I feel like a proud dad of Melissa. I keep forgetting that she's so, not that much younger than me, but she looks way, way better than me. So.
Oh my gosh. What do you think? First of all, congratulations on almost being done your PhD. I know that's a huge feat, especially while working full time. Maybe a question for both of you is around, what do you think has made your connection so strong over the years? Have you ever kind of stopped to think about, you know, why you clicked, why you've, you know, been able to stay in touch for all of this time?
I don't know.
I can't live without him. I owe him for the rest of my life. And there's many, many, many more stories that could be told of how and why he saved my life. He didn't need to do any of that. And he did. And, yeah, so he's always going to be in my heart forever and always.
One of my favorite times was her 10th birthday, her 10th sobriety birthday. And it was, of course I was there, and so were a bunch of recovering gangsters.
Wait, that Dan Jones, what is he doing here?
And then pictures, like they call them pen pictures. So when you're in the, when you're in the pen, you pose like hard face. And we got pen pictures with a bunch of the guys there. So it was funny, you know,
because
I didn't need to do, I needed to do those things because I didn't want Melissa to be 6 feet under either. And I'd love her. I do. I love her. She's family. She's one of my favorite people. And watching her be successful makes all of the shitty things that happen in policing worthwhile.
I'm so glad to hear that. I think you just have such an inspiring and unique relationship. And I just want to thank both of you for taking the time to chat with me today and share your story and being so open with it. It's just very inspiring to listen to and to hear. So thank you very much for that. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention just before we close?
No,
I'm just really happy to be here. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to share a little bit of my story. And like I said, that was just a little bit. Like I said, I'm loud and proud. So I've made a very huge impact in all areas of my life. but I'm really grateful to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope. And hopefully it could inspire, like my passion would be for the youth, because I started at a young age and I hope that someone would hear that and be like, okay, let's change my life. You know, that's my hope.
And I've seen Melissa do that. She came and worked at one of the schools that has a high, unfortunately, it's a junior high school. One of their biggest issues is sex trade work within the junior high school.
Okay. Wow.
Spoke to those young people, and then really started mentoring some people with one of our constables, Val Hoglund. Mm-hmm. And she's taken that passion and done it before she was even getting paid to do it. It was literally, she just was helping for the right reason, but she also has to eat. So it's nice if she gets a job that pays her to do it.
That was a really crazy experience too, just because there's 30 students and half of them are drug dealers and the other half are street, like underage prostitutes, like hard teenagers. And they're all looking at me like, who the hell are you? And you don't know me, like with that attitude that I same had. Mm-hmm. But of course I'm like, I have poop in my pants. I'm scared as hell. Like, and when I'm talking, I'm vibrating because I want it to come out right. And I want them, you know, I want hit home for them. Right. So I did what I had to do. I spoke on behalf of my story, and out of all 30 kids, I made one cry. So that really happy. I know that sounds horrible, but she cried for a good reason. And you know what? She's a very huge success right now. She's 4 years sober and off the street.
That's great.
And I'm very proud of her. So, and I've stayed connected. And like I said, I didn't get paid to go pick her up and take her for ice cream, to spend that time with her, to be like, how's your day? You know what I mean? And, so me and her also have a very great connection. Yeah. So I'm very proud of her.
That's fantastic. You're now the Dan in someone else's life. So that's brilliant.
Right? Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, thank you both again. I know it's not always easy to share these stories and experiences, but you know, Melissa in particular, I have no doubt that you're going to touch many more lives, and congrats on just such an amazing journey in your life. So congrats on everything you've achieved. It's so well deserved, and I can't wait to hear and see what you do next.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you've enjoyed it, please help us spread the word by leaving a rating and a review. Thanks very much, and we'll see you again soon.